talking to me?
Funny like I'm a clown, I use you.
Here's Johnny.
He's looking at you, kid.
We're on a mission from God.
Go ahead. Make my day.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
Good morning. It is. What is today? January 2nd of 2017. It's a new year.
2 days in already. My goodness.
And this is the We Are Movie Geeks podcast. My name's Tom Stockman.
Jim Batts.
Lynn Fenhouse.
Lynn Fenhouse is here as our guest. Thanks for joining us, Lynn.
Well, thank you for
Lynn,
asking.
Lynn, of course, reviews movies for the Belleville News Democrat and also the Kirkwood Webster Times.
Yes.
And the current issue has your and Kent's choices for the best of the year. So you got to pick that up at your local newsstand or wherever.
That's right.
Fine newspapers are given away.
Right.
That was right. That West was thrown End in Word. My yard.
West End Word? Our no, Webster Kirkwood Times. West End Word has it in this week, and next week will be the Webster.
You write for West End Word, too? Or is it
the same? It's the same company. Mm-hmm. Oh, the Times newspapers, West End Word, South County Times, and the Webster Kirkwood Times.
Neat.
Yes.
All right. Well, we got a lot to talk about today. Usually we start out with the top 12 at the box office, but Michelle's going to be calling in. So we're actually going to push that back to later in the show so she can join us. So we're going to start out with some reviews. We got lots to talk about. We got four movies to review: Assassin's Creed, Hidden Figures, Passengers, and A Monster Calls. And we got some local stuff to talk about and a couple of people who have died we'd like to talk about. And then we're going to talk about our favorite movies of 2016, which has just ended. So let's get started. Jim loved Assassin's Creed.
His name is Callum Lynch. We've traced his bloodline back 500 years to the Assassin's Creed.
I loved when it was over. I'll tell you, this is not the worst film based on a video game this year. I think that still goes to Warcraft and the Angry Birds movie. But that, like I say, this is based on another long-running video game. I guess it's been around for about 12 years. There's been six or seven incarnations of it, so it was inevitable it was going to come to the big screen. But what is surprising is the high-profile cast involved.
Yeah.
Basically, this is a reunion of the director and the stars of last year's Macbeth, or 2015's Macbeth, which is surprising that they would lend their talents to a video game-based movie. But the plot is, well, it has something to do with the war between the Assassin's League and the Knight of Templars in, Spain during the time of the Inquisition. And it's when it starts out, you see a big battle at the start, and then it goes right to 1986, and you see a young boy riding his bike through the desert, comes home, sees his mom is dead, and his father is wearing the uniform, the little hooded thing that you see in the posters of the Assassins, the League of Assassins. And they hear the choppers coming, and there's some shadowy organization, you know, that's on their way, and the kid escapes. And next time you see the kid, he's grown, and he is Michael Fassbender playing Cal, and he is on death row. He's going to get the old lethal
injection.
So something
takes place in the contemporary?
Yeah, it goes
the whole
right
movie
from,
goes?
What's that, sorry?
The whole movie?
Well, it keeps on going back, to the time of the Inquisition.
Oh,
I guess in the 1600s, 1500s, whatever. 1600s.
Okay. I thought it all took place in the 1600s.
No. They do a little switcheroo with Cal when he gets on death row, and when he, after the lethal injection, he wakes up and he's not dead. Instead, he's in some sort of bunker laboratory run by Marion Cotillard, who's playing a character called Sophia. And she and her father, who's played by Jeremy Irons, they have this big thing, or this big scheme, is they're going to use this mechanical device called the Animus to hook in to Cal's subconscious, because he's the latest in the long line of the Assassins.
They should have Jeremy Irons play Fassbender's father, because they kind of look alike.
A little bit, yeah.
Just my opinion there.
Kind of a father figure to him. So they hook him up into this big thing that kind of resembles the device that Dr. Octopus got hooked up to in the second Spider-Man film. And this device takes him back, and he's Aguilar, a assassin in 1600 Spain. So he's working through things, and I guess they're trying to find some device called the Apple of Eden. And it holds lots of secrets, and supposedly this is a way for Jeremy Irons' character to eliminate violence from the world. And it's pretty ridiculous. But the thing it's so frustrating in it, they have all these big battle scenes and action scenes, and they're shot through fog and smoke and lens flares from the sunlight.
Is it in
3D? And you can't see what the hell's going on, you know?
Did you see it in 3D?
I believe I saw it in 2D. I would imagine 3D would probably be even murkier.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just kind of ridiculous. And it,
is it boring?
It's boring. It's mm-hmm. boring. You're just kind of waiting for him to get hooked up to this thing again. And there's other people that have been shanghaied that are, you know, being tapped into the animus there. And they get a sort of revolt together, and they're going to escape and get out of there into the modern world.
How long a film is it?
It's way too long.
Is it over 2 hours?
It's close to two, or you know, it feels like it's over two. So it's just dreadful. I tell you, it might satisfy hardcore fans of the game, but for fans of Fassbender and Cotier and Irons, and yeah, actually Brendan Gleeson and Charlotte Rampling have small roles in this, thankless little cameos. So it's definitely one of the year's worst films, that's for certain.
Two Oscar winners in it.
Yeah, and you go from Macbeth to Assassin's Creed. That's a heck of a jump for this this trio. But yeah, it's just so incompetently shot. The action stuff, and it's all the parkour stuff. The assassins in 1600 Spain are kind of acting like ninjas in a video game, climbing up the sides of buildings and all that. And it's just ridiculous.
So you reviewed it for WeAreMovieGeeks.com. How many stars?
I think I gave it one. Yeah. So just barely that. Just cause a Fassbender. He's trying his hardest, but his character's got nothing to do besides go through the motions when he's hooked up to this machine. So,
all right. So Jim doesn't like Assassin's Creed. Let's move on. I reviewed Passengers.
120 years hibernation means a wake up in a new century on a new planet. But a year ago, everything changed.
For WeAreMovieGeeks.com, I gave it 2 out of 5 stars. It's not a very good science fiction movie. It stars Chris Pratt as a fellow named Jim who's on some sort of spaceship heading to a planet.
I like the guy already.
It takes 120 years to get to this planet, and that's in the future. So this planet must be very, very far away. Oh. And that's because they're going to colonize on this planet because there's overpopulation back on Earth. It's never explained why they have to go so darn far to find a planet that's inhabitable. Do they explain?
I guess that's the only one they found.
But if it's 120 years to get there in the future, so that must be many solar systems away from ours.
Yeah.
I mean, is there no planet closer they could find to inhabit?
Hey, Matt Damon could plant potatoes on Mars, so that's not that, that far.
Yeah. So anyways, he wakes up 30 years into this 120-year trip, and he's the only one still awake, because there's 5,000 other passengers aboard, but they're all sleeping in these pods, and he says, what the heck, why am I awake, doggone it? He never really figures out why he was awoken, and he spends the next year growing a beard and playing basketball and playing video games.
Isn't that the strangest design for a spaceship you've seen? Yeah. It looks like, you know, a good wind would break it.
And it doesn't look like it's moving very fast either, which is probably why it takes 120 years to get rid of it.
Is this
going.
Based on a book or anything?
No, it's not based on a book.
I read one review where there's a big twist, and
it's not really a twist, because it happens about 20 minutes in or 30 minutes in. He gets really lonely, and there's this beautiful woman that he's become sort of obsessed on, who's sleeping in one of the pods, and of course her name is Aurora, because she's a sleeping beauty, and he looks on her little profile, and it turns out her father was a Pulitzer Prize winner, and she's a writer, and he thinks she's so pretty, and he just stares at her sleeping in this pod for a long time, and he goes to the bar that's on the ship that's run by this robot bartender named Arthur, played by Michael Sheen, and he asks his advice, should I wake up this woman so I'll have some companionship? And he says, sure. So he goes there, he wakes her up.
It's kind of like the rotisserie area there, the rotisserie chicken. He picks out the best looking one. Yeah. It's like,
I don't wait. I was going to wake up somebody on the ship. I'd wake her up too. But when he wakes her up, he's pretty much doomed her. Because once you're woken up, you can't get back into the pods and go back to sleep. So he's doomed her to die on the ship, because there's still another 90 years in their voyage. So she's not going to live another 90 years. But gosh, she's really, really lonely, so you can't really blame the guy. So he wakes her up, and he doesn't tell her what that he's the reason that she's awoken.
Yeah, of course, when I saw the trailer originally, I thought that both of their pods simultaneously. No. And but I was talking with a friend of mine, and he had not seen the film, but he says, oh, he woke her up, didn't he? And it's like, boy, aren't you cynical? It's like, yeah. I just assumed that it was a glitch that took out both of them. Like I said, Andy Dwyer from Parks and Rec wouldn't do such a terrible thing.
Yeah, well, so now he has somebody to play video games with, and oh, she has first-class status, so actually they get better food after they've woken her up. And they watch movies together and eat popcorn, and then they end up, you know, in bed together, so I guess his plan worked after all. And then she finds out, well, I guess I won't go on with too many spoilers in the plot. There is another crew member that actually wakes up, too, and he's played by Lawrence Fisher. And although when he wakes up, he's coughing up blood, so you know he's not going to be awake for too much longer. And he sort of explains a few things to them. And then it turns out there's this crisis where the ship has been damaged, and Jim has to sort of go into action mode to save the rest of the
he's
passengers.
Crew member Machina. Yeah. he tells them how to survive, pretty much.
But it is kind of weird, this whole, you called it a plot twist, but this plot development about a half hour in where he does this to this woman, and then, but what do they call it, Stockholm Syndrome, I guess, where she's still madly in love with him, even after she finds out that he's the one who woken her up.
A crisis kind of spurs that, you know, it kind of proves his mettle during a crisis.
Yeah, but it's. Like I say, it's not very good. It's not very well written. Her character's kind of a ditz, and she runs around with these fashion designer dresses on and has her makeup and her hair all in place, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Well, there has to be robot hairdressers and makeup artists.
I suppose.
Because they have waiters and all that in the restaurant. Yeah.
And at the end, I don't care. Whoever's going to see this movie has already seen it by now. Andy Garcia makes the most pointless cameo I've ever seen. He just kind of basically walks through the frame at one point. I don't know why they bothered giving him a paycheck for this film.
Well, I must say, though, for special effects fans, there's a spectacular scene. There is a pool in there, and the gravity system shuts down, and so Jennifer Lawrence's character is trapped inside this floating water, and she just can't get out, and it's pretty great.
That's the best action scene. And she looks... Oh, there's several scenes with her swimming in that pool in this mesh bikini. Those are spectacular scenes as well.
Yeah. How is the chemistry between Chris Pratt and Jennifer Lawrence?
You wish they were in a better film.
Oh, yeah.
I think if they were in a standard real rom-com...
He's poorly cast. Well, they should have made this more like a remake of Saturn III, and they should have cast Michael Douglas in the gym role. And then had like a killer robot and just made it a full-blown remake.
And Michael Douglas could have shown his derriere like Kirk did in
Exactly. That would have livened it up a bit. But I wasn't bored with this film. That's why I gave it 2 stars. It's pretty bad. It's poorly written, but I sort of enjoyed it on some levels. And its sort of political incorrectness sort of amused me because it was just so out there.
I think it got universally trashed.
They don't have much faith in it, the studio.
Yeah, although it's not doing terribly at the box office.
Hear what it did.
I think it was number 3 the past 2 weekends.
Well, that's on pure star power.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's definitely.
People like those two actors.
Yeah. Right. Hollywood doesn't know what to do with Chris Pratt, though.
They're wanting to poise him as the next big action star, and I don't know if that's quite going to work, but we'll see.
All right. Well, let's move on. So we don't really recommend Passengers, although it's not the worst movie of the year. All right. You guys both saw Hidden Figures.
Yes.
You're a computer at NASA. They let women handle that sort of...
Yes, it's an uphill battle.
Yes, they let women do some things at NASA, Mr. Johnson. And it's not because we wear skirts.
To me, it's a stand-up and cheer kind of movie. It's about, smart girls and math nerds ruling. It's about 3 pioneer women in NASA in the early 60s, the space program, and they're African-American women. Their real names are Dorothy Vaughan. She was a coder. They called them human computers at NASA then, because obviously that was the technology then. And the mathematician is Katherine Johnson, and that's Taraji B. Henson. And then Janelle Monáe plays the first black woman African-American.
Was that their names in the movie?
Yeah, those are their real names. Okay. Yeah, the real names of the women. It's Dorothy Vaughan, Katherine Johnson, and Mary Jackson.
Isn't Katherine Johnson Whoopi Goldberg's real name?
Karen Johnson.
Oh,
Karen Johnson.
I stand corrected.
And so these are trailblazing women back in the segregation time of Virginia, because they work at Langley Air Force Base in Virginia. So there's a lot of that segregation, like the male workers in the NASA space program. Where Kevin Costner plays a composite of three real guys. Oh, yeah. And he's the boss, and they got to get to space. They got to beat the Russians, and nobody in the room knows analytical geometry. But Katherine Johnson comes in, saves the day, and John Glenn is her biggest fan. And
who plays John Glenn?
And that is a guy named Glenn Powell.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
And he looks—he's really a good character. But it's all about the segregation that they faced and the. Their co-workers, Jim Parsons plays a guy that is very jealous of Katherine Johnson.
Okay. So who's the acting standout?
Octavia Spencer, I think, of the women. She's always good.
She was with Kevin Costner in a Black or White last year.
That's true. And is in that film, Kevin Costner eradicates racism in this film. Okay. So thank heaven for Kevin Costner.
Okay. Yeah, it's a little heavy on the symbolism. However, they're strong actors, and so it, but it is. It's when I saw the screening of it, I've never seen an audience cheer and break into applause as much for this movie in the past couple years.
Throughout?
Yeah, throughout the movie, people broke into applause and talked back to the screen and were cheering.
Were they
drunk? Guess where we saw it, Tom? Guess what?
Or at the Esquire?
Yes.
Oh, okay. All right, enough said.
And so, anyway, it's one of those. It's one of those feel good. This is a real story, the untold true story.
Well, you know, our friend Joy, who works here at ONSTL, she said this was her favorite movie of the year.
I think it's a woman thing, because I put it on my top 10.
You did?
Yes.
Well, I haven't seen it.
No, I will say it's a little Lifetime-y.
Oh, boy. Oh, brother.
But I just like for what it stands for. And
what's the
pioneers.
Title refer to there?
They were hidden figures at NASA. Like, nobody's known about them. The woman who wrote the book on which this is based, her dad was an engineer at NASA. And when she was a kid, she was at these parties with these women, these backyard barbecues and stuff. So when she got to be an adult, she was like, how come nobody's told their story?
Yeah, she thought they were the wait staff.
Well, you know, my problem with the film, this is kind of a cross between The Right Stuff and The Help. And
The Right Help.
Like The Help, this is kind of a more of a sugar-coated version of the civil rights movement. Nobody really gets hurt. They're kind of scared a little bit by a sheriff or by a highway patrol car at the start of it. But it's you know, a little too cutesy at times. They seem to think it's really funny to watch Taraji P. Henson running through the NASA training area to go to the colored only bathroom. They think that's very funny, her getting rained on and all that. And they have this ridiculous scene. I think I mentioned about Kevin Costner as the sympathetic white guy that's going to help all these poor folks. And they actually have him. I'm going to go ahead and spoil it. They have him destroying a colored only bathroom sign, and it was just the most ridiculous thing I've
ever
seen.
All right, so are you reviewing this for Weird Movie Geeks?
No, Kate is.
If you were to review it, how many stars would you give it?
I'd give it 2.5.
2.5. Yeah. But Lynn liked it a lot. Lynn liked Hidden Figures and put it on her top 10 best of the year list, and Jim didn't like it nearly as much. And we've got one more movie to review, and that opens this Friday. It is called A Monster Calls.
Everything about you. The truth that you hide. The truth you dream.
Jim will be reviewing that for We Are Movie Geeks. How many stars are you going to end up giving A Monster Calls, Jim?
I'm probably going to give it 4 at least, depending on
Jim
how I feel after I read
it.
Yeah, it's pretty strong.
I saw it.
Yeah, it's very, very well done. And it's not a monster movie, really. It's more of a family drama, but there's a monster in it.
Oh, there's definitely a monster in it.
Yeah. He's wonderful. Yeah.
It's based on the children's story, but it's more of an emotional fantasy drama.
Yeah.
It's a four-hanky weeper, I think.
It's kind of like, it's got a lot of Charles Dickens and Stephen King sort of mixed together. It's kind of an odd tone.
Exactly. This is the film that Louis Drax maybe wanted to be and failed miserably at being. Yeah. But yeah, this has probably one of the best CGI creations. Definitely the best sort of tree monster I've seen since Groot in Guardians of the Galaxy. Maybe since the little tree monsters in the Lord of the Rings film.
Or from Hell It Came.
That's right. Tabanga or whatever his name was called.
Yeah, but, well, it's a lot more complicated than normal children films.
Oh, yeah. There's some tough stuff in it.
Oh, yeah. It's about cancer is what it's about.
Yeah. If you've become a fan of Felicity Jones after Rogue One, I would definitely check it out. Yeah. She's very strong in this.
And she really looks like a woman who has cancer. I mean, sometimes in Hollywood, they'll put, like Julia Roberts in Steel Magnolias, they'll put a little dark makeup under her eyes. Oh, I'm dying. But this woman, she really looked like she had cancer. She was all emaciated.
Oh, yeah. And she's a very good actress. She was so good in Theory of Everything. Oh, yeah.
She was. Everyone was fawning over Eddie Redmayne in that, but I thought she was definitely his equal, if not better.
She makes everybody look better, I think. Diego Luna in Rogue One. Well, the real star of the movie is this Lewis McDougall, and he plays the 12-year-old Connor who has to deal with a lot. His mom's terminally ill. His grandmother's kind of cold and distant, and she's played by Sigourney Weaver.
Yeah, with a questionable British accent.
Yeah.
And then his dad is pretty absent, and then he's got a new family in America, and then he's got these bullying classmates, so the poor kid's going through a lot.
His dad was played by Ben Hur.
Yeah, Toby Kebbell.
Yeah, that's his name.
And he's out in California, and he comes in for a visit, but he says, "Oh, it's too crowded in California for you to come back and live with me." And you're like, "Well, what a weasel," you know?
And
the bullying scenes reminded me a little bit of Sing Street in those sequences.
But
this kid's a good actor. He carries this movie on his shoulders. But his scenes with, could go ahead and say Liam Neeson is the monster doing a motion capture thing, and it's his voice, and their scenes together are terrific. And what's interesting is the monster, when he comes to visit the kid on these evenings, he says, "I'm going to tell you three stories, and then you're going to have to tell me one." And each of these three stories is told in a different way with a different film technique. One is more standard 2D animation, and another sequence, I think, is closer to the animation from Kubo and the Two Strings. And it's really, really well done, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Liam Neeson is great, and he's in the film. I don't know if we should, but he's really the deceased grandfather.
Yeah.
So that's an added thing because you see him in family pictures. But he's more of a mentor than a monster.
Yeah, he's his secret friend, kind of his invisible friend. So, yeah, this is a really nice film. It's from the director of The Impossible, if you remember that a few years ago, the tsunami film, which was very, very well
with
done.
Tom Holland, the new
Spider-Man. So this he gets a good performances out of child actors. So this is a strong film.
It is.
I think. Yeah,
it's better than what was it, BFG? Another movie you could compare it to.
Yeah, but better, but much better than the BFG, I think. Yeah. And yeah, much more dramatic. And
this one didn't have farting dogs.
That's true. But yes, and I say I nominated this one. I think this is one of our candidates for visual effects. Film Critics Awards.
It was.
So the effects are really nice. So.
Yes, and bring your Kleenex. Oh, man. Whew.
Yeah, it's a good one. And you know, like I say, formal performances are, you know, everybody's good in it, you know?
All right. So Jim will be reviewing A Monster Calls. Look for that this Thursday night at WeAreMovieGeeks.com. And he's going to give it at least 4 stars, maybe even 4.5, he said. I like the movie a lot, too. I'd probably give it 4. How many stars would you have given it, Lynn?
I'm going to give it 3.5 out of 4.
3.5 out of 4. That's, I thought you were on the 5-star system.
No, you're on the 4.
So you're going to give it 3. So Lynn likes it, too. So we all recommend A Monster Calls. That opens this Friday, and Hidden Figures, that opened this Friday also?
It's supposed to, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. The only other movie that we're going to go see maybe this week, hopefully we'll see it this week, is Silence. That is the sort of wild card at the award season this year, because very few people have seen it. The people who have seen it are praising it. It's a 3-hour-long film by director Martin Scorsese, and it's about missionaries from Bolivia who go to Japan in the 16th century. It stars Andrew Garfield and
Liam Neeson again.
And Adam Driver.
Adam Driver, yeah. I don't know a whole lot about it. I don't want to know a whole lot about it. I want this movie to sort of unfold in front of me, and I don't know when we're going to see it, though.
It's an epic on Christianity, and Martin Scorsese took 28 years to make it.
Yeah, so we're not sure if we're gonna if it's gonna be opening this Friday or the next Friday.
It does not open this Friday.
It opens the 13th.
Definitely opening 13th, the 13th.
And the landmark, the Tivoli.
Yeah,
the Tivoli.
Well, I hope that's not gonna be the only place for it.
No,
it might be exclusive.
Oh yeah. No, but that's why we knew it got moved.
Okay.
You know, right. So
hopefully we'll be back next week. We don't know if we're going to see that this week or not, though.
And the only other movie opening is the Underworld one.
Oh, yeah.
Underworld 8, 9, whatever it is.
They're not showing that to us.
No.
I get all those Underworld movies mixed up.
Yeah. Well, this one has Kate Beckinsale back in the black leather, so...
Can't go wrong with Miss Beckinsale.
That's true.
All right, there's a bunch of stuff going on locally. My 16mm double feature night is tomorrow night, and I will be showing Bonnie and Clyde from 1967. Followed by a thriller from 1965 called My Blood Runs Cold, starring Troy Donahue and Joey Heatherton. Remember, she used to do those mattress commercials?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Perfect sleeper.
Yeah. I can't really place her in anything else except those mattress commercials. Although she certainly was a figure back in the 60s and 70s.
Oh, sure.
And
she made all married, the variety shows.
Yeah, and she was married to a football player that got in trouble for exposing himself.
Yeah. And she was one of the brides of Bluebeard in that Burton film.
That's right. I like that movie. All right, so now I can announce what I'm showing next month at... 16mm double feature night. That'll be February 7th, which is Tuesday night at 8 o'clock. I'll be showing a comedy from 1982. This is one of everybody's favorite comedies from the early 80s. It stars Eddie Murphy, Dan Aykroyd, Jamie Lee Curtis, Don Ameche, Ralph Bellamy, and Rick Baker in a gorilla suit. It is, of course, Trading Places.
Paul Gleason.
That'll start at 8 o'clock, and this is Roger Burke's collection of 16mm prints, and he claims that the color is spectacular on it, and he also claims it is uncut print, which is great news for fans of Jamie Lee Curtis's Rack, because that is one of the best topless scenes from the 80s right there, Jamie Lee Curtis in Trading Places. And that will be followed by another really good movie, this from my collection from 1975, a thriller, sort of a backwoods thriller called Macon County Line.
Wasn't that Nick Nolte's first movie?
No, you're thinking of Return to Macon County.
Yes.
The sequel. Okay. No, this is the first one. It stars Jesse and Alan Vint, who are a couple of character actors you'll recognize. They were in tons of movies.
Oh, yeah.
Alan was in Chinatown, and they were in a lot of movies in the 70s and 80s. And it also stars Max Baer, and it was written by Max Baer, and he actually wrote it during the final season of the Beverly Hillbillies. He actually wrote the screenplay on the back of his Beverly Hillbillies scripts and helped finance it himself and was a co-producer and plays the sheriff.
He's not the director, though.
No, he's not the director.
Yes.
And it's really good. It was a huge hit in 1975. You know, it drive-ins and things like that. I actually saw it. I was like 12, and my dad took me out to the Ellisville Cinema to see it. And I watched the first reel of my print, and the color's really good. Although, you ever seen it?
Mm-hmm.
It's been a while.
Well, it opens in this whorehouse, and the room and they're in this room with these two prostitutes, and it's lit with this red light. And so I was watching. I go, damn, this print's really red. Well, it turns out when that scene ended, and they jump out in the street and they're running around, then the color actually shifts and it becomes really good again. So I was mistaken.
Good,
it's not a red print.
So it's a red light district.
Yes, it was a red light. So that'll be February 7th over at the Way Out Club, 2525 Jefferson. It's starting at 8 o'clock. Trading Places and Macon County Line. That is a free event, although we do set out a jar and collect donations for the National Children's Cancer Society. This Wednesday night is The Quiet Earth at Schlafly. Have you ever seen that?
No. I've never heard of it, actually.
Never heard of it? Oh, it's spectacular. It's the last man on Earth science fiction story from New Zealand. I saw it at the theater twice when it first came out in 1985. It stars Bruno Lawrence, and he wakes up, and he's the last man on Earth, and he kind of does what Heston did in The Omega Man. He tries to make the best of it, but then all of a sudden he finds this woman, and he also finds this black man, although I guess in New Zealand they're Maori or whatever. And so it's kind of like the similar dynamics to The World of Flesh and the Devil, which was also about a white man who woke up as the last person on Earth and found a woman and a black man to hang out with. This is really good, though. Supposedly it's Neil deGrasse Tyson's favorite movie, for what that's worth.
He's got a big fan base.
Yeah, so it's really good. And that's this Wednesday night, which will be January 4th at Schlafly Bottle Works as part of the Strange Brew film series. And that starts at 8 o'clock, and I think it's like $5. I went and saw Die Hard. They had Die Hard on the 23rd, Friday the 23rd at High Point at midnight.
Yes.
They're starting a new midnight series at the High Point, believe it or not.
Oh.
They haven't shown midnight movies at the High Point since Andy had to move his late night grindhouse out of there.
That's an odd choice to start it up again. They didn't want to be open that late.
It was the night before Christmas Eve, so they wanted to show Die Hard, and 130 people showed up. I was really surprised. I thought maybe they'd get 40 or 50, but I'm introducing this new midnight series. But Diane, who runs things over at the High Point now. Oh, speaking of High Point, you see Brian got married?
No.
Brian Ross at the High Point got married over the weekend.
No, it is.
So congratulations to Brian Ross over the High Point. Brian's a great guy. I've known him for many, many years.
Oh, he is.
Off topic there. Anyways, Diane says she wants to start a new mid-series, but she just wants to start it once every 2 months for now and see how it goes. But I think, considering how many people showed up for High Point, she'll probably bump that up to once a month. The next one will be Animal House. And that'll be Friday, February 25th. They're only doing it on Friday. They're not doing it on Friday and Saturday, just Friday. So that will be February 25th, Animal House at the High Point. Speaking of midnight shows, next weekend is Friday the 13th. So guess what Andy's showing for a late night grindhouse?
Yes. What is it? Is it number five?
It's number five. I can't get these 13th movies straight. Lynn, which one is number five again?
That's not the seven is the best one, isn't it? The Friday the 13th, the seven, the guy from Belleville directed it, John Cole.
Oh, yeah, but that's not one of the best ones. I don't think. I mean, I sort of get them mixed up.
I get them all mixed up.
I think four is considered to be the best. Three is the one in 3D. That's a lot of fun.
And that's where he dons the mask for the first time, right? Yeah.
And then 10 is the one where it takes place in outer space. That's really a fun one, too.
Where's the one in that he goes to Manhattan? Is that
that's like
eight
or nine or something like that. I don't know. But he's showing part five, which Andy says is the sleaziest entry, for what that's worth.
Oh, okay.
Okay, good to know.
Yeah. This weekend at Webster U is a documentary called Songs for a Long Life, and it's about people who are in hospice care, and they sing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That music therapy is a very real thing.
That's what it's about. Friday, Saturday, and Sunday night, starting at 7:30 over at Webster University. It's an hour-long documentary. Again, seven songs for a long life. Sounds like something they'd show at SLIF or something. But who knows? And the only other local thing I wanted to mention. Oh, my toy speech. All right. At the Missouri History Museum over on Lindell Boulevard in Forest Park, they have an exhibit up. And Lynn saw this exhibit over the weekend. It's called Toys of the 50s, 60s, and 70s. What did you think of that exhibit, Lynn?
Oh, I enjoyed it immensely. It's really quite the walk down memory lane. They have three living rooms set up, one 50s, one 60s, one 70s. The thing is, it's a very crowded, it's a big draw, so it's really crowded. So you probably need a lot of time. To go through and see everything, but they even have the bad toys, the clackers, and the charts.
Oh, yeah, the dangerous toys.
The dangerous toys. But they have a trivia game that's kind of fun, and it's very well done. It's smaller than you think it's going to be, though, don't you think?
It's from Cleveland or Cincinnati?
Minnesota.
They should have put it together a collection from collectors of local collectors. I don't know why they didn't. And maybe it was just easier to bring this collection, this
yeah, and it's only till January 22nd.
Yeah. Well, anyways, I'll be speaking at the Missouri History Museum next Thursday, which is January 12th. And I'll be delivering a lecture called From the Screen to the Playroom, Movies, TVs, and the Toys They Inspire. I did not come up with the name for that lecture, by the way, but I kind of like the name of that lecture.
What time is it?
7 o'clock. It's a free event, and I'll be talking about movie and TV-related toys because I collect movie and TV-related toys from the 60s, and I'll probably stick mostly with 60s, and I'll probably be talking mostly about toys from my personal collection because that's what I know most about. I'll probably talk for an hour and 15 minutes and then maybe answer questions after that. Again, that's 7 o'clock next Thursday, January 12th at the Missouri History Museum.
And they do have like James Bond toys and they have Batman.
Oh, they have some monster toys.
Yeah.
Well, the Aurora model kits in the exhibit look like they were painted by a 4-year-old. That bugged me. But I guess maybe they're trying to show up what a toy might look like if a little kid had it or something.
They have an interactive slinky thing. They have the steps and you can do it on the...
aside from the animated characters, there really is not very many movie tie-in toys from the 30s and 40s, are there?
No, they didn't really market toys that much.
Yeah.
Because most movies, except for animated movies, were marketed for adults.
Yeah, they have the 50s is more of the westerns.
A lot of those. Yeah, you're right, though.
A lot of westerns.
And
stuff.
A few science fiction.
Yeah. But it's definitely worth, you know, checking out, especially if you owned a bunch of those Matchbox cars and Hot Wheels, and my Barbie collection was right in there.
And my Barbie collection too. All right.
Hey, another film that you might want to bring up is that Carousel is going to be the Fathom event. It's going to be January 8th. And 11th.
Really?
I think
I got the information on that.
Yeah, Shirley Jones, and I got an email about it.
Gordon McRae.
Yeah. Yes. You know, it's not politically correct.
Oh, good.
But it is, Time Magazine named it the top musical of the 20th century.
You're kidding. Carousel? What songs are from it?
June is Busting Out All Over?
Yeah, and it's If I Loved You. You'll
Never Walk Alone.
Yeah, You Never Walk
Alone.
I've heard
that song. I heard the first two you mentioned.
Oh, that You Never Walk Alone.
That's a classic.
That's a classic, and people sing it like Barbara Streisand.
Jerry Lewis used to always sing that at the muscular dystrophy telethon at the end.
Right, and Barbara Streisand.
They break down crying.
After 9/11, Barbara Streisand came on the Emmys and sang it.
Yeah, and If I Loved You, will you mention that?
Yeah.
It's from that? And You're a Queer One, Julie Jordan.
Right. That's right. But yeah, June is busting out all over.
Right.
And Mr. Snow and all that.
Oh, all right. Yeah. I saw at the Webster last Friday the 23rd, was A Christmas Carol. But it was this weird 1935 version with some British actor. I can't think of his name. No, it was one of the Alistair Sim version was like 51. This was 1935, and I can't think of this actor's name. It was Sir somebody.
Yeah.
And he had starred in a silent version of Christmas Carol like 10 years earlier, and he had played Ebenezer Scrooge on stage. That's what he was kind of known for. But it wasn't very good. It was only about an hour and 10 minutes long, and the print looked like they projected like an old SP VHS tape up on the screen. It was all fuzzy. You couldn't tell what the heck was going on. I sort of commend them for sort of thinking outside the box and showing this more obscure version of A Christmas Carol, but they shouldn't really do that if they can't get a decent print.
Yeah.
Just a little complaint there.
I like the George C. Scott one. I know that's not...
I like
not
the Albert Finney one, the musical.
Yes.
I wish they'd have shown that. Yeah. And actually, it wasn't called A Christmas Carol. It was called Scrooge, the 1935 version.
Yeah.
All right, so let's move on. Yes, we did lose, of course, Debbie Reynolds and her daughter, Carrie Fisher, on the same day, or one day apart, I should say.
Yeah.
Just a few days ago. Very sad, very unusual for a parent and her child to die so close together who were so famous. I can't even think of, in history, that happening before.
Yeah.
I'm sure it has, but... we're not going to spend a whole lot of time talking about them, although we did admire them. And what do you want to say about old Debbie or Carrie, Jim?
Oh, I think Debbie was just had a great career, fabulous career, started in 1948, and she's in one of the greatest films of all time, Singing in the Rain, which everyone seems to remember. But I forget that I think she might have had a top 40 tune with the theme song from Tammy and the Bachelor. That was a huge hit, still played on the radio on the oldie stations. And I want to remember her for The Unsinkable Molly Brown.
Yeah, Oscar nomination.
Yes, Oscar nomination.
Major role in How the West Was Won. And I think we were talking here during the break there how good she was recently, or fairly recently, as Alba Brooks' mother in Mother.
Yeah, 1996. Yeah. But she was also the Singing Nun.
Oh, the Singing Nun, yeah. She was in the first film I saw in a theater.
Oh, yeah.
Goodbye, Charlie, with Tony Curtis in 64.
Oh, I remember that one.
Yeah. Everyone seemed to think she was a real sweet character on screen, but she could be really tough. She was very tough in this movie. Another movie with Tony Curtis called The Rat Race. She was in a great comedy with James Garner, How Sweet It Is, with Dick Van Dyke in Divorce American Style. So she's made some interesting choices in her career.
Okay, and her daughter, Carrie Fisher, who preceded her in death by one day, also had a pretty spectacular movie career.
Sure, because not only was she Princess Leia and returned so forcefully in The Force Awakens, she was now a general, which I love about Princess Leia being from princess to general. But Carrie Fisher had such a great wit. She wrote books, Postcards from the Edge, and her one-woman show, Wishful Drinking. They showed it on HBO last night. By the way, there's a documentary about both of them because they live next door to each other, and it's called Bright Lights, and it was supposed to be shown in May on HBO, but now they've moved it up to this Saturday, January 7th.
Yeah, okay. And she was a script doctor. I heard she had done that, and I looked it up on Wikipedia. It said she was a script doctor on Lethal Weapon 3, Outbreak, The Wedding Singer, and Stop or My Mom Will Shoot. So,
She was, and then she was a great talk show host, and also she was in When Harry Met Sally.
Oh yeah, she's a lot of movies. She was in Austin Powers.
And the Blues Brothers.
In two movies with Tom Hanks. She was in that The Man with One Red Shoe and The Burbs. Played his wife in it. It's great.
All right. So RIP to Debbie Reynolds and her daughter, Carrie Fisher. We've got Michelle McHugh on the phone. Hello, Michelle.
Hi there. Hi, Jim. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Michelle.
Hello, Michelle.
And you're going to call in and talk about some box office statistics like you used to do all the time before you got one of those pesky day jobs.
Exactly. Comscore reported that the 2016 box office hit $11.4 billion.
Whoa.
That's a 2% increase over last year.
That's great.
It's a new all-time record. Widest number of movies on the blockbuster side of the ledger and an auspicious crop of smaller-scale films brought enthusiastic patrons to movie theaters across the U.S. and Canada throughout the year, giving the industry its biggest overall revenue in North American box office history.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Well, Disney had six of the top, didn't it? Doesn't Disney have six of the top ones?
Yeah, the list, as far as the list, the ranking, they listed 1 through 10, with number one being Finding Dory. Disney's film was the biggest draw. It came in at $486 billion at the box office.
Wow.
What was that number again?
Million.
486 million.
Yeah.
But didn't Star Wars last year make more than twice that?
Correct, yeah.
Okay. So it's really not that impressive.
Rogue One, A Star Wars Story came in at number two with $408 million.
Okay. All right.
Number three was Captain America Civil War with $408 million, just ranking below Star Wars. So you take a look at the top three were all Disney products. Disney/Marvel/Pixar/Lucasfilm, but Disney is the distributor ranking all three.
Okay.
Yes.
Keep going.
Number four was Universal Secret Life of Pets with $368 million. Coming in at number five was Disney's The Jungle Book. Number six was Deadpool from 20th Century Fox. That's R-rated superhero blockbuster came in at $363 million.
Okay.
Number seven was Zootopia, Disney's animated film, and kind of, I don't know, one of the top frontrunners for best feature animation at the Oscars. That was at $341 million.
That's my favorite.
Number eight was Batman vs. Superman: Dawn of Justice from Warner Brothers.
Yay!
$30 million. Oh. And number nine, also from Warner Brothers, was Suicide Squad, $325 million. And rounding out the ten was Star Wars: The Force Awakens, with $284 million. And that was a crossover. Those were one of the holdovers from 2015.
Yes. Okay. Where was Shin Godzilla on this list?
I saw that on your list. Good job on that, Tom.
Okay. Well, it should have been on the top 10 list, although it only played 5 times in St. Louis. All right, well, good. So that is the top 10 at the box office, not over the weekend, but of the entire year of 2016.
Correct.
Neat. All right, so now we're going to talk about... Did you want to talk about the top 10 at the box office over the weekend? Because Rogue One was number one, and Sing, and...
See, they didn't release that, so there is no rest check. They'll probably release it today or tomorrow, but as of right now, there wasn't an actual...
Yeah, and nothing new opened on Friday, so I guess that's really not that important. All right, let's move on. We're going to talk about our favorite movies of 2016. Lynn and Jim and Michelle and I are each going to talk about where we stand on the best films of 2016. Let's start with number 10. Michelle, what was your number 10 favorite movie of the year?
Rogue One, A Star Wars Story
was Michelle's favorite. My number 10 favorite was Neon Demon, Nicholas Winding Refn's sort of bizarre movie about fashion models who eat each other. Really interesting film. Lynn, what was your number 10 favorite movie of the year?
A taut thriller, Eye in the Sky.
I just watched that last night with my family.
Yeah. And Michelle, I'm with you with my number 10. It's Rogue One.
Jim's is Rogue One. Right. So far, Rogue One's ahead. All right. Excuse me. Number nine. Michelle, what was your number nine favorite movie of the year?
Jackie
was my number nine favorite movie of the year, too. It really was.
Wow.
It's on my list right here in front of me. Yeah, Jackie with Natalie Portman is Jackie O.
I think she was still Jackie Kaden.
Oh, I'm sure she'll see a nomination.
Oh, I hope she wins. I hope she wins.
And, Lynn, what was your number nine?
My number nine was Hidden Figures. It's a stand-up and cheer female type of movie.
Okay. Jim?
My number nine was Manchester by the Sea, which is going to bring an Oscar for Casey Affleck. There's no doubt about it in my mind.
And that's my number two.
Oh, you spoil it?
Oh, I'm sorry.
All right. Now we're that brings us to number eight. The all-important number eight. Michelle, what was your number eight?
I went back and forth on this one. It was actually Michael Hafner's number one, High Rise.
High Rise, all right.
Couldn't make it through it, sorry.
No, neither could I.
I made it through it, but I thought the first half was really superb, and I thought it sort of fell apart in the second half. But that's fine. I'm glad you and Michael liked that film. It was sort of a stylish, unusual film. My number eight was Elle, and that stars the wonderful Isabelle Huppert, and it's the rapiest film of the year and also one of the very most interesting. Number eight for you.
It was left off the list for foreign language for the Oscars.
But I think she'll be nominated.
Yes, I do too.
Okay, Lynn, number eight for you.
Sing Street, a charming ode to the transformative power of music from John Carney.
Okay, we got to pick up the pace here a little bit, guys. Jim, number eight.
Number eight, my favorite comedy of the year, The Hunt for the Wilder People.
I saw that. I don't remember it too well.
I loved it.
Yeah.
Okay. Jim liked The Hunt for the Wilder People. Number seven. This brings us to number seven, Michelle.
The Witch.
That's
scary, but I had to put it on my list.
Oh, it's on my list, but much higher. Very good. Number seven for me was The Lobster. That starred Colin Farrell, and that was a really bizarre movie by a Greek director making his English language debut. Fantastic film, The Lobster. Number seven for you, Lynn, was?
Moonlight.
Okay. Okay, Lynn liked Moonlight. Jim liked for number seven?
It was De Palma, my favorite documentary of the year.
Yeah, De Palma was a damn good documentary.
It was.
Very entertaining.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right, now we come down to number six. Number six for you, Michelle, was the classic.
Midnight Special, Michael Shannon, I really
love
that film.
Oh, yeah, Midnight Special. I kind of forgot about that film.
I put it on my honorable mentions.
Oh. My number six was Shin Godzilla, which I just mentioned a little while ago. A wonderful reimagining of the Godzilla legend from Toho Studios in Japan. They teamed up with this anime guy, and it's the most unusual film of the year and fantastic. Number six for Lynn was?
Zootopia, a colorful kaleidoscope by Disney, melting pot metropolis.
There you go.
Loved it. Cheeky wit.
Jim, number six.
From the director of Midnight Special, It's Loving, which is just a wonderful dramatic film.
Hmm.
Yes, it is.
So he had a good year, that fella.
Yes, I love him. Okay. He's great.
Lynn loves him. All right, good. And this brings us to number five. Michelle, what was your number five favorite movie of the year?
Number five was Moonlight. And Lynn and I, we also belong to the AWFJ. That was our number one pick for best film of the year as well. So it's just, I see it as one of the top three for best picture.
Okay, and my number five was Hell or High Water, starring Jeff Bridges and Chris Pine. That's on a lot of top ten lists of the year, and it's a fantastic movie. Number five for you, Lynn, was
Sully.
Sully.
Tom Hanks is the true blue American hero.
All right.
Miracle on the Hudson.
Number five, Jim?
My favorite horror film, The Witch.
The Witch, of course. Jim liked The Witch a lot. Number four, that brings us to number four, Michelle.
La La Land. I think it's going to be in one of the top three. It's all about Hollywood. They love movies about Hollywood. So that's my number four pick.
My number four pick was Todd Solondz's Wiener Dog. Had the most clever script of the year and a couple of the best performances of the year with Ellen Burstyn and Danny DeVito, believe it or not. The Wiener Dog is fantastic. Number four for you, Lynn, was?
Loving. Jim already mentioned it.
Jim did mention it.
Great
true story, indeed. Jim, number four?
Number four, Lynn already mentioned it. Sing Street.
Sing Street.
Fabulous musical.
All right. good. Number three for you, Michelle, was?
Mel Gibson's Hacksaw Ridge.
Oh, yeah.
Look for that. I mean, did well for the Golden Globe nomination.
Yeah, I see it as a dark horse at the Oscars. My number three was The Witch. Hey, I was really conflicted with two and three. They're basically a tie, but I had to put The Witch at number three. I think it's the best horror film since The Devil's Rejects almost 10 years ago. It's astonishing. Lynn, that brings you to number three.
Hell or High Water. Mentioned it. Just crackling dialogue and a great atmosphere.
And my number three is also Hell or High Water.
Oh, crazy. All right, good. And that brings us to the coveted number two spot. Michelle, number two.
See, so my number two was Hell or High Water. That film just, and where's Chris Pine? Where's he been acting all this time? I mean, the Star Wars movies or Star Trek movies, but still, Hell or High Water, what a great film.
It was a fantastic film. And my number two was Woody Allen's Cafe Society. Woody Allen is 81 years old and is just working at a really amazingly high level for writing and directing Cafe Society. I'm surprised it's not on more top 10 lists, but it is what it is. I loved it. Number two for you, Lynn, was?
Manchester by the Sea, the most emotionally devastating performances of the year. So well constructed. And Casey Affleck will win Best Actor.
Okay, Jim, you're number two. Drumroll.
Number two, giving us hope for the superhero films, is Marvel Studios' Captain America: Civil War.
Captain America. All right, well, good. And this brings us down to number one. This is so exciting, isn't it, guys?
Yes.
Yeah. Number one for Michelle McHugh of 2016 was.
I had to go with the very unique sci-fi adventure Arrival.
Arrival.
She just fooled me. Had to be my number one.
Okay. Michelle loved Arrival. My favorite movie of 2016 was Mel Gibson's Hacksaw Ridge. Mel is an amazing director, and this is just an incredible true story. Everything about this movie was true. I actually did some research, which is really surprising. This Desmond Doss, what a hero, and what a great job Mel Gibson did in telling his story. Number one for Lynn was...
La La Land. It reminds you why we love movies, and it's just so beautifully told. Damien Chazelle, the cinematography is fabulous. The music, Brian Gosling and Emma Stone are just a great couple. You got to see it on the big screen. It's just magical.
Okay. I saw that on Christmas Day at the High Point, by the way.
Oh, good. Good.
That's the second time
I've seen it. That's the perfect place to see that film, actually.
Oh, you haven't seen it yet?
I'm just saying, if you're going to go see it, that's a great venue to see it
at. Oh, no doubt about that. That's the best theater in town. All right, and that brings us to number one for Jim Bass, and that is
also La La Land, which I'm predicting will get the Oscar for Best Picture. I'll say it right now.
Okay, Jim thinks it's not only the best movie of the year, La La Land, but it's going to win the Oscar for Best Picture. And this brings us to the year 2017. And all kinds of great movies coming up. Lynn, what movie are you most looking forward to in the year 2017?
On October 6th, Harrison Ford, Ryan Gosling, Blade Runner 2049.
And it's directed by Denis Villeneuve, who's in Arrival. So he's kind of on a roll for him. Good.
Yes, I'm excited.
Jim, what is your most anticipated film of 2017?
Well, it's tough because there's three Marvel Studios films, but I'm going to go with Star Wars Episode VIII. I'm going to hopefully see what these characters do. So,
okay. Hey, Michelle, what's your most anticipated film of this coming year?
Alien Covenant.
When is that open? Is that open this summer?
Yeah, that opens in May, actually, as a matter of fact.
Okay.
And Guardians of the Galaxy, too.
No, I only said one. You only get to pick one. Take one of those back.
Oh, okay, sorry. Okay. But there's so many good ones coming out.
Well, of course there is. But my most anticipated film of the year, of course, is Baywatch, and that opens this summer. If you could have asked me what the perfect cast for a Baywatch movie could possibly be, I would have said Alexandra Daddario and Dwayne Johnson. And what do you know? They star in this Baywatch movie, and the trailer, I just watch it over and over and over again. I cannot wait to see Baywatch. We're going to have to wrap this up, though, doggone it. Michelle, thanks so much for calling in, and we're glad to hear from you again. Lynn, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you for asking.
Jim, you and I will be back next Monday for sure, and we'll review some stuff and talk about some stuff. But for now, we got to sign off. I'm Tom Stockman.
Jim Batts.
Lynn Venhouse.
And?
Michelle McHugh.
And we'll see you next week.
Black leather, rock. Black leather, ta-ta-ta. Black leather.
Oh, nutty steak. Hello, darling.
Hey, 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 hey.
Black leather, black leather, rock, rock, rock. Black leather, ta, ta, ta. Black leather, hip, hip, hip. I got that feeling, black leather rock.